The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, from which I will be reading, is dated June 12, 2023. As usual, it is outlined in a red border on the front cover with a narrow inner border. Our 100th year remains the signature thumbprint portion of the front cover. And dominating it is a portrait of Ron DeSantis, Florida governor. This looks like a photoshopped photo or an illustration. He's standing in front of, first of all, Time in large capital block lettering in white on top of a charcoal gray background. On either side of the governor, on my left, is the American flag. On my right is the Florida flag, great seal of the state of Florida, appearing on that, dressed in a dark or navy blue suit, white shirt, and gray tie. Governor DeSantis is looking steely-eyed, with steely, I would say, gray-green eyes, neither smiling nor frowning, with well-coiffed brown hair, peeling, and orange. Beginning with The View. This is an excerpt of Finding the Words by Elliot Page. Page is author of Page Boy, from which this essay is excerpted. I'd always been told I was gay, made fun of for it. I felt comfortable in environments with queer women. But something in me knew that I was transgender. It was something I had always known but did not have the words for, would not permit myself to embrace. I was never a girl. I'll never be a woman. What am I going to do? I used to say, have always said. The first time I acknowledged I was trans in the properly conscious sense beyond speculation was around my 30th birthday, almost 4 years before I came out publicly. Do you think I'm trans? I'd asked a close friend. They answered hesitantly, knowing no one can come to that conclusion for someone else. But they looked at me with a quiet recognition and said, I could see that. It was a light shining through from under the door. Then there was the time when I was not the one to bring it up. I was having a small party. People jumped in the pool and huddled together on outdoor furniture. My friend Star and I sat off alone, catching up on the patio. I met Star when we were making the first season of Gaycation. She worked at a San Francisco clinic run by trans women that offered health care and support for those in the LGBTQ+ community who needed it. Star and I connected in that way where the future flashes, an auspicious beginning. We stayed in touch and became good friends. She has experienced far more obstacles and barriers than I have, yet she holds space for me, supports me, sees me. She is a singer, and I remember being mesmerized by her voice when I first listened to her album, Star. The lyrics of her song, Heartbreaker, played on repeat in my mind for weeks after. I run away from feeling too good. I'm scared as hell. You'd leave me if you knew. I run away from feeling too good. I'm scared as hell. You'd leave me if you knew. At my party, we sat together on an oversized chair, the splashes and music blending together in the background. We spoke about gender. I shared the degree of my discomfort, how even when I was playing a role, I could not wear feminine clothes anymore. how I always struggled in the summer when layers were not an option and the presence of my breasts under my T-shirt forced me to incessantly crane my neck, sneaking quick peeks down. I would pull on my shirt, my posture folded. Walking down the sidewalk, I would glance at my profile in a store window, my brain consumed. I tried to avoid my reflection. I could not look at pictures because I was never there. It was making me sick. I did not want to be here. I wanted to be lifted out, the gender dysphoria slowly crushing me. It is a role. You are an actor. Why are you complaining? People would say. I would wear a skirt, a straight cis man said to me, playing devil's advocate. I kept trying to explain the difficulty I was having, but he kept spitting out his unwanted opinions, then berating me for getting too emotional. I believe hysterical was the word he used. His words triggered a deep shame I had held since I could remember. I was puzzled, too, invalidating my own experience. How was I in so much pain? Why did even slightly feminine clothing make me want to die? I am an actor. There should not be a problem. How could I be so ungrateful? Imagine the most uncomfortable, mortifying thing you could wear. You squirm in your skin. It's tight and you want to tear it off your body, but you can't. Day in and day out, and if people learn what's underneath, who you are without that pain, the shame will come flooding out, too much to hold. The voice says you deserve the humiliation. You are an abomination. You are not real. Do you think you're trans? Star asked me, locking eyes. Yes, well, maybe. I think so, yeah. We exchanged a soft smile. I was so near, almost touching it. But I panicked, and it burned away like the joint I was smoking, becoming an old roach left to rot in a forgotten ashtray. It all felt too big, the thought of going through this publicly, in a culture that is so rife with transphobia, and people with enormous power and platforms actively attacking the community. The world tells us we are not trans, but mentally ill, that I am too ashamed to be a lesbian, that I mutilated my body, that I will always be a woman, comparing my body to Nazi experiments. It is not trans people who suffer from a sickness, but the society that fosters such hate. As actress and writer Jen Richards once put it, it is exceedingly surreal to have transitioned 10 years ago, find myself happier and healthier than ever, have better relationships with friends and family, be a better and more engaged citizen, and yes, even more productive, and then see strangers pathologize that choice. My being trans almost never comes up. It's a fact about my past that has relatively little bearing on my present, except that it made me more empathetic, more engaged in social justice. How does it hurt anyone else? Sitting with Star by the pool, I could not quite touch the truth, but I could talk about my gender without bawling. That was a step. It had taken a long time to allow any words to come out. When the subject came up in therapy, I got lost in sobs. Why do I feel this way? I'd plead. How can I have this life and be in such pain? Not long after my 30th birthday, I did a U-turn. I bailed. I stopped talking about it. I closed my eyes and hid it away. I met my ex-spouse, Emma, around that time. Meeting Emma let me leave it behind, a foggy memory. Falling madly in love, the energy was indisputable. Just a hug would make my body shake. I threw myself in, and we got married quickly. If a part of you is always separate, if existing in your body feels unbearable, love is an irresistible escape. You transcend. A sensation so indescribable that philosophers, scientists, and writers cannot seem to agree on what the F space CK it is, if it even is. I often wonder if I have actually experienced deep love. I feel as though I have, but is it real if you've numbed yourself to the truth about who you are? Love was an unwitting emotional disguise, and my relationship to it is another muscle to be transformed. I'm working on it. I do not want to disappear. I want to exist in my body with these new possibilities. That sense of possibility is one of the main components of life lost when we lack representation. Options erased from the imagination. Narratives indoctrinated that we spend an eternity attempting to break. The unraveling is painful, but it leads you to you. During my marriage, I ignored therapy. And when we moved to New York City from Los Angeles at the end of 2018, I virtually stopped going to therapy altogether. It was not until our relationship was falling apart 2 years later and my gender dysphoria was so extreme that I sought out someone in the city. I was ready to talk. I could barely find the words, but I did. As if they moved on their own, wriggling through and up my body, pouring out. My body knew, deep down I knew, and something had shifted. It was now or never. It was alive or not. There is a photograph here. It is uncaptioned. It may be Elliot Page, the author. It's a young person, a young man, wearing blue jeans and a white undershirt with a dark metal chain around the neck, tattoos on both arms, but small, tiny, fabricated words, it appears to be. Short, dark hair, dark brown eyes, looking towards the camera. Now, what the caption does say is that in March 2021, Page became the first out trans man to appear on the cover of Time. And there is a tiny photo here of the Time cover of what appears to be the same individual with the same kind of haircut and the same face, wearing blue jeans and a sweater. And there is a caption here saying, if you or someone you know may be experiencing a mental health crisis or contemplating suicide, call or text 988. Turning the page now to The View, Pride, essay, The Only Way Forward After Pulse, P-U-L-S-E, by Brandon Wolfe. Wolfe is an LGBTQ activist and the author of A Place for Us. There is a photo here. It is captioned. It's in the dark. But there are lots of colors here because the photo is populated by a lot of people. Some of the people are holding candles. Most of the people are wearing brightly colored T-shirts along with shorts or slacks. Mourners attend a vigil June 13, 2016 for the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Orlando. Growing up in rural Oregon, I often dreamed of a world where I could be all of myself, a world where I did not feel the nagging societal pressure to be black enough for some spaces and white enough for others, a world that saw my queerness not as a deal breaker, but as a superpower. Pulse nightclub embodied that for me. After packing two suitcases and running away to the refuge of Orlando, I found what I'd been looking for. The spinning disco balls dared all of us to dance like no one was watching. The beats radiating from the floorboards unearthed our authenticity, nudging us into rhythmic protest against a world that had always told us to uncross our legs, stiffen our wrists, deepen our voices. Inside those walls, we were normal. When I close my eyes at night, I can remember the moments when that normal shattered into a million shards, June 12, 2016. I can feel it, hear it, see it. The vibrant poster above the urinal, the cup teetering on the edge of the sink, perched precariously as if it might tumble to the tiles below, the first cracks of gunfire from an assault rifle, the stench of blood and smoke wafting into the room. Hours later, the world woke to our horror, 49 dead, 53 injured. LGBTQ communities across the globe reeled with the jarring reminder that no space is safe, when your very humanity is perpetually up for debate. The celebrations over marriage equality and surging social acceptance were suddenly cleaved by violence. Overnight, ours was a community under siege, picking up the broken pieces of the nation's deadliest attack on LGBTQ people in history. This community remains under siege today. Florida, just years removed from that horrifying tragedy, has become synonymous with the breathtaking assaults on LGBTQ civil rights sweeping the nation. From book censorship to healthcare prohibitions on trans youth to bathroom bans, Governor Ron DeSantis and his right-wing allies have ushered in a raft of dehumanizing policies designed to build political careers at the expense of our civil liberties. These laws are all animated by the same dangerous ideology that has long been used to rationalize discrimination and violence against LGBTQ people. That we are a contagion whose spread can be stopped only by wielding the power of government to censor us out of society. This utterly absurd argument is peddled alongside promises to protect the children from us in an effort to force us back into that makeshift closet. The demonization of LGBTQ people is not new. Whether it was the police raids that led to the Stonewall riots or the HIV/AIDS crisis that fueled the ACT UP movement, this community has had its back against the wall countless times before. And at each pivotal point in history, we blazed a new path forward. We willed a better, more inclusive future into existence by sharing our stories and choosing radical love over the ferocious hate threatening to consume us. In the wake of the tragedy at Pulse 7 years ago, Orlando faced a similar critical choice. We could succumb to the TV pundits. We could beat the drums of war, or we could choose love. We could embody the spirit of Pulse itself, unapologetically becoming a city that dares everyone to dance as if no one is watching. We chose the latter. We chose love over hate. When I left home, I did not expect to fall in love with a new community. I never thought I would watch that community traverse the flames of militarized hatred, and I could not have imagined our struggle to put the pieces back together might demonstrate when hate tries to terrorize us into submission and tear us apart at the seams. There's another path. We simply must choose to walk it together. U.S. Sage Lanier. This is from a list of next generation leaders put forth by Time magazine. SAGE LENIER, Centering Solutions in the Climate Fight by Kyla Mandel. For climate activist Sage Lanier, 24, education is a tool for empowerment. Too often, she says, higher education focuses solely on the problems instead of exploring solutions to the world's many pressing environmental challenges. The result can leave students feeling overwhelmed and depressed. So in 2018, as a 19-year-old student at the University of California, Berkeley, Lanier designed Solutions for a Sustainable and Just Future course. Since then, it has enrolled over 1,800 students, 600 of whom Lanier taught herself. We are advocating for a better climate education that really prepares us for what a climate change future is going to look like, she says. More than just rethinking how we learn about environmental problems, it is a bigger system-wide perspective that drives Lanier's work. The goal, she says, is to inspire young people and equip them with the tools needed to figure out how they can best take action right now. I am not going to sit around and wait for sweeping national legislation. So, what can you do at the city, state, county level to push the needle, she says. building on the program's success at Berkeley. In the spring of 2021, a one-time virtual version of the course was made available online in partnership with the nonprofit Zero Waste USA. And in January, Lanier, who recently completed a fellowship with the Op-Ed Project and the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, helped launch the Sustainable and Just Future nonprofit with the aim of bringing the solutions course to other universities around the world. You should not be able to get a high school diploma or college degree without having a basic understanding of the ecological systems that keep you alive, says Lanier. Seeing the tangible impacts of the course was transformative for me, she says. According to surveys by her nonprofit, 71% of students have said they are, or plan to be, involved in an environmental organization or initiative thanks to the course. People would come out of the program and say, I'm a different person. I've decided to do X, Y, Z with my life. I have decided to start this community initiative, she says. Being able to hold space for that change, that is the most important thing I need to do. Turning the page to new generation leaders in South Korea. New jeans, K-pop's next act, by Chad de Guzman. Hyein, that's H-Y-E-I-N, I may not be pronouncing it correctly, just turned 15. But her birthday wish is unusually purposeful for a teenager. I want to show more of my skills and different sides of me that I have not shown yet, she says. This youthful drive to keep growing is a common denominator among Hyein and her NewJeans bandmates, Minji, Haerin, Hani, and Danielle, who are all under 20, and they're all photographed here in a group shot. They look all under 20. They have long, dark hair, big brown eyes, and most of them are wearing shorts and midriff tops. One is wearing a bow in her hair. Well, it's not really a bow. It's kind of a band, and one is wearing a cap. A year ago, no one knew who NewJeans was, but since it dropped its first music video in August 2022, the nascent K-pop girl group managed by the record label ADOR, Adore, a subsidiary of the South Korean entertainment behemoth HYBE, more acronyms, which launched boy band BTS to international acclaim, has already reached global milestones even faster than its more senior counterparts in the industry. Two of NewJeans' singles stayed on the Billboard 100 for 5 weeks this year, and in March the band became the fastest Korean act ever to hit 1 billion streams on Spotify in just 219 days. Despite having released only a handful of songs. This August, NewJeans will become the first K-pop girl to perform at Lollapalooza. NewJeans' popularity is not exactly surprising. Adore CEO Min Hee-jin was once responsible for the branding of many enduring names in the K-pop world, like SHINee or SHINee, EXO, and Girls' Generation. Now helming her own label, Min has spoken of breaking established industry expectations, which resonated with NewJeans members. The band's name is a wordplay on New Jeans, N-E-W space G-E-N-E-S, as in the next generation of K-pop and the timeless style of denim. I should spell you the name of the group. It's NewJeans, N-E-W-J-E-A-N-S, one word. We're always trying to create a fresh vibe, says Danielle of NewJeans' distinctive style. Clear. Y2K influences, more acronyms, appear in their fashion and their songs, produced by musicians known for their experimental, more underground discography. This is new, but it's also bringing back all these memories from the past. as cutthroat as the K-pop industry is said to be. The members of New Jeans are happy to take things in stride. They are focused on enjoying the process and just making music that they want to hear. K-pop is such a big thing, Hani says. I don't know if you could really even predict what it's going to be in the future. One more item from Time's Next Generation Leaders, this from the UK. Matt Fitzpatrick, an exemplary athlete, by Sean Gregory. Matt Fitzpatrick, the emergent golfer who will defend his 2022 U.S. Open title, or who did, at the Los Angeles Country Club in June, leaned on a neat mental trick at this year's Masters. Fitzpatrick, 28, had not fared well at Augusta in previous starts. Since 2016, he has finished on average in 27th place. So, he recalibrated his expectations. Anything better than that, I've got to take the positives from it, says Fitzpatrick. I felt like that kept me grounded throughout the week. Fitzpatrick finished tied for 10th, his best in 7 years. A week later, he won the PGA event in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Following his early spring roll, Fitzpatrick rose to 6th in the world golf rankings, tops for his career. As golf seeks out players to carry the sport into the post-Tiger Woods era, Fitzpatrick is making his play. He's taken an intensely analytical approach to improving his game, incorporating sports science. Fitzpatrick closely monitors his sleep video breakdowns of his swing and other stats to gain an edge. We've done a lot of work with that, says Fitzpatrick, just to find those small 1% gains. I'm always pushing to be better. Fitzpatrick grew up in Sheffield, England, spending summers on putting greens instead of at parties with his friends. As a rail-thin 18-year-old, he became the first English player in 102 years to win the U.S. Amateur Championship. Fitzpatrick turned professional in 2014 after playing a handful of tournaments for Northwestern University. He's kept close ties to home, acting as a fundraising ambassador for the Sheffield Children's Hospital and donating $80,000 to help pay for a new CT scanner there. He has also donated to UK charities that research neurological disorders and offer countryside holidays for patients suffering from Parkinson's, MS, and other conditions. I do think it is important to give back, Fitzpatrick says. If Fitzpatrick triumphs in Los Angeles, he will join Curtis Strange and Brooks Koepka as the only men's golfers to win back-to-back U.S. Opens since 1989. Playing conditions, as usual, at the U.S. Open are certain to be difficult. I do not feel like any holes give you a breather, he says. The fairways are tight, the greens are firm, the roughs high. It is mentally fatiguing, as well as physically. Not to worry, Fitzpatrick's proved to be good at staying grounded and being a force to reckon with in golf. The Brief 2030 Business, a rideshare app that brings people along, by Charlie Campbell. The lunchtime rush is just bubbling at Kide Kopi Hawker Center in Singapore's Clementi neighborhood when Anthony Tan strolls in. The co-founder and CEO of the ride-hailing firm Grab orders himself a Horlicks malt drink, sits at a Formica table, and takes a sweep of the bustling vendors. One catches his eye, a stall selling nasi lemak, the signature Malay dish of fragrant rice cooked in coconut milk and pandan leaf. Back in 2012, Tan used to offer it to taxi drivers, gassing up in his hometown of Kuala Lumpur, pitching his upstart service while they ate. But because we could not afford to do a deal with the petrol station, they chased us out, Tan, 40, recalls. He decamped to a nearby sidewalk by fetid monsoon drains. It was so smelly, he says, but it was close enough to shout over, "Hey, uncle, do you want free Nasi Lemak?" That's N-A-S-I space L-E-M-A-K. In the years since, Grab has transformed from a street-fighting startup, as Tan puts it, scoring Southeast Asia's biggest NASDAQ IPO in 2021, valued at around $40 billion. But that has not kept Tan sequestered in his office. Opposite the Nasi Lemak stall is another for fiery Peranakan seafood, where Tan pulled a four-hour shift during the pandemic. With lockdowns decimating Grab's ride-hailing business, it pivoted to food delivery, and Tan wanted to better understand vendors' needs. He ended up cleaning live crabs and absolutely covered in bits of shell and crab juice, he laughs. But I saw that when the orders came out in English, the Chinese-speaking chefs could not understand them. After that, we made the tickets in both languages. Tan's anecdotes help to explain why Grab, with a market cap of $12 billion, is one of Southeast Asia's most valuable firms. Its green attire delivery drivers are ubiquitous in over 500 cities across 8 nations. Often compared to Uber, Grab is much more. Fast becoming a fully-fledged super app offering insurance, travel bookings, financial services, and more. Tan envisages making Grab a triple bottom line company, measuring success not only by its balance sheet, but also by its social and environmental impact. Particularly through the financial services it now offers. Southeast Asia may be the world's fastest growing region economically, but those gains are uneven, and 70% of the population is underbanked, not relying primarily on traditional banks. Tan's pitch is that by bringing more small businesses into the digital economy, he can boost Grab's earnings while fostering equality. There are many ways you can build social impact and create financial impact. They are not mutually exclusive, he says. If you do not build a society that is stable and you do not uplift the bottom, it becomes all of our problem. Mobility is in Tan's genes. His great-grandfather was a taxi driver, and his grandfather an automotive tycoon. After attending Harvard Business School, Tan decided not to join the family business, Tan Chong Motor, which his father runs, but to go it alone. Inspired by classmate and Grab co-founder Tan Hui Ling's horrific experiences with Kuala Lumpur taxis, by some rankings, the world's worst, Tan asked his dad to back their ride-hailing venture, but was told, "Your head is in the clouds," he says. So he went to his mom, who thought the same, but still agreed to back him. Moms are amazing, right? Still, for a young man born with a silver spoon, Tan admits, the move was scary. "My dad basically disowned me," he says. "I thought, I'm not going to grovel, I'm going to fight and make sure we win." That was a pivotal moment. Whereas Uber took a cookie-cutter approach to global expansion, Grab's growth was rooted in being hyper-local. In Cambodia, it offers tuk-tuks. In Indonesia, users ride pillion on motorcycle taxis. While Uber launched delivery ice cream, which often arrived in a slushy mess in the unforgiving tropics, Grab rolled out Southeast Asia's king of fruits, durian, which remains a huge money spinner. But like any disruptor, Grab has faced pushback. In Thailand, where it operated illegally until rule changes in 2021, local taxi competitors held protests against Grab, brandishing placards of Tan in a coffin. "This job is not for the faint-hearted." Meanwhile, Grab's shares now trade at less than a quarter of their IPO price. Tan puts this down to timing, given the drying up of cheap money. These setbacks have not deterred Tan. Last August, Grab launched one of Singapore's first digital banks in partnership with telecom firm Singtel and is rolling out more across the region. Interest is paid daily instead of monthly, and small loans can be approved in minutes. For Tam, the need was made plain by a conversation at church. A fellow parishioner confessed to spending a stint in Singapore's Changi prison for being a loan shark's goon who would splash pig's blood on debtors' homes to intimidate them. He said there were thousands of people like him in Singapore, says Tam. It is fundamentally wrong to charge somebody 20% a day interest because you're putting them in a real poverty trap. The pandemic served as another inflection point. While ride-hailing ground to a halt, lockdowns also meant small businesses had no choice but to embrace digitization. Buoyed by government stimulus packages for small businesses, in just 1 year, Grab added over 600,000 merchants across the region, offering everything from dog bowls to apple strudel. The COVID crisis became an opportunity for us, says Tan. It was also a lifeline for people like Suparno, 52, who, like many Indonesians, uses one name. The father of three owns a tiny fruit stall in Bali's Taman Sari Market, which overflows with lush mangosteen, papaya, and watermelon. When Indonesia shut its borders during the pandemic, tourism-reliant Bali suffered more than most, and Suparno's trade fell 70%, he says. Struggling to feed his family, he became the first vendor in Taman Sari to join GrabMart. By selling his fruit via the app and using its data crunching service to bundle in-demand items together, trade quickly recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Today, practically every business in Taman Sari displays a green GrabMart logo, and Suparno plans to open a third stall. But the leap to digital revealed other benefits. Suparno's business was previously cash-based, which meant carrying around large wads, a risky proposition, or braving long 9 a.m. queues at the bank before heading to the wholesalers, by which time the best fruit had often been snapped up. Now, any GrabMart sales Suparno makes before midnight appear in his GrabPay account by 4 a.m., meaning he can restock before the bank has even opened. It helps a lot because mornings are my busiest time, he says. It demonstrates how better access to digital financial services helps small businesses compete, which Tan hopes will translate into higher revenue for his firm. Grab's financial services revenue grew 233% year over year in the first quarter of 2023, with loan disbursements up 45%. In 2022, small merchants on Grab saw a 26% increase in average monthly earnings after a year on the platform. Still, despite boasting over 32 million monthly users and expecting revenue of $2.2 billion in 2022, Grab has yet to turn a profit, with Tan expecting to finally break even by year's end. Grab's success is also their problem, says Jeffrey Tosin, an investor and consultant on digital strategy in Asia. They are dominating the market with high-frequency services, lots of engagement, which means lots of data. But they're still struggling to get profitability because that is just the nature of the business they're in. Supplementing the low-margin ride-hailing sector with higher-margin add-ons is a main driver behind Tan's super app vision. He says it also helps merchants to boost their income through secondary services. Drivers can earn from deliveries, but also by hosting advertising brokered via the app, or wearing a helmet camera funneling data to Grab's own Maps offering, which it sells to third parties like Amazon Web Services. Last year, 72% of Grab's drivers earned from more than one of its services, while over 1 million took part in one of its 2,500 training and upskilling courses. When we create more inclusion, society benefits, says Tam. What's good for society is good for business. Here's a photograph by Ephraim Lukotsky, AP. White box. It is a double spread, a two-page photo. Bright blue skies. A tree trunk with some leaves growing from its branches. Kind of a rickety-looking automobile in the foreground. And a large pipe with fire or an explosive emanating from it. Lots of greenery in the background. A person, a soldier in camouflage, standing in the very foreground, leaning over, holding his ears. The caption reads, "A Ukrainian soldier fires a mortar at Russian positions on the front line near Bakhmut, Ukraine, May 29. The nine-month battle for the city, which Russia claimed to have taken, presaged a long-awaited summer offensive by Ukraine. We are preparing the battlefield for the new phase of the war," Mykhailo Podolyak, a senior advisor to Ukraine's president, told NBC. "It is going on now. It is a large number of measures in different sectors of the front line." More next generation leaders, according to Time. U.S. Rose Traore. R-O-Z-E space T-R-A-O-R-E, Blending Two Cultures by Solcira Borga. Like many American children of immigrants, Chef Rose Traore navigates two worlds. You can see it in the way he switches between saying Côte d'Ivoire and Ivory Coast when he discusses his new boutique hotel and restaurant, La Fourchette de Rose, located in the West African country. And in our conversation about the difficulties of opening his restaurant abroad, "Just because I'm from Ivory Coast, or my parents are, does not mean that it is not a culture shock for me," Traore, 32, says. "There were certain ingredients that I thought I would have the luxury of having any day, any time when I create a menu in the States. That process proved more difficult in Ivory Coast, but with new ingredients came new opportunities to innovate." Traore opened La Fourchette de Rose in January with the mission of bringing something new to his parents' native culinary culture. "My approach was never to come in and just take away African food. That is something that they do perfectly," Traore says. "But given my background, I wanted to add and introduce them to a different approach, which is how far I could take these ingredients and merge them together." Traore, who's also a model, stumbled into his cooking career as a teen who was seeking a form of connection. "Food is always going to be there to heal us. Food is always going to be there to bring us together," he says. He studied at Le Cordon Bleu in Portland, Oregon, and rocketed to early fame working at 11 Madison Park in New York City and cooking for the 2022 Guggenheim International Gala. When he decided to open his own restaurant, he knew it would be in Grand Bassam, the beach town outside Abidjan, where his grandparents had taken him on vacations when he was a child. The popular tourist destination was impacted by a 2016 terrorist attack, which left the community reeling and led to a decline in visitors. But since then, the arts and culture scene has helped the town flourish. The buzz from La Fourchette de Rose's opening is also boosting tourist interest. "I wanted to pick a place that was special and meaningful, so when I did open, it had a true identity of who I was," Traore says. "These are my roots. This is where my family came from." From Australia, Melanie Perkins, Visualizing a World of Good in Tech. by Simone Shaw. Melanie Perkins, co-founder and CEO of the online graphic design tool Canva, C-A-N-V-A, has a two-pronged plan for success. First, build one of the world's most valuable companies. Next, do as much good in the world as possible. The two goals fuel each other, Perkins, 36, tells Time. The philosophy might seem like an odd North Star for a company offering templates for presentations and save-the-date cards, but it is just one way Perkins is reimagining the modern tech company. Headquartered in Sydney, thousands of miles away from Silicon Valley, with its reputation as a global arbiter of innovation, Perkins has built a design platform that easily rivals those offered by giants like Adobe and Microsoft, all while keeping accessibility at the heart of its mission. After launching in 2013, Canva has grown to offer services in over 100 languages, with 125 million users in 190 countries. The company operates on a freemium subscription model that includes basic features at no cost, with the option to pay for upgrades. They also provide free subscriptions to educational organizations and nonprofits. The company counts 85% of Fortune 500 companies among its users, but Perkins believes the most salient examples of the company's impact are in how it has changed everyday lives, from refugees using the platform to design resumes as they job hunt in a new country, to a woman creating a flyer that helped her track down her birth mother. In 2018, the year Canva joined the ranks of unicorn startups, valued at over $1 billion, just 9% of those new companies had at least one female founder. Recent numbers are likewise dismal. In 2021, the number was only 14%. Perkins has been comfortable going against the grain. There's always been forks in the road where we could do what every other company is doing, or just do what feels natural. Every time we do what feels natural, it always ends up being the thing that we build on. Argentina, Bizarrap, that's B-I-Z-A-R-R-A-P, elusive hitmaker by Moises Mendez II. Bizarrap cultivates an air of mystery, so much so that when he first started gaining popularity, people questioned whether he was a real person. The Argentinian producer and DJ can usually be spotted in the background of his videos, back to the camera, shades obscuring his eyes, giving the floor, or more accurately, the mic, to the artists he invites on the mega-popular YouTube music video series he started 4 years ago. "What I like most is that people get to know my music," he says. His numbers are impressive. 7.2 billion views on YouTube, 41.8 million monthly listeners on Spotify. Several of his videos and songs have hundreds of millions of views and streams. And Bizarrap, real name Gonzalo Julian Conde, C-O-N-D-E, has done it all without releasing an album. His meteoric but unconventional rise signals a shift in the industry, proving that newcomers do not have to follow a certain path to find their audience. On his channel, the 24-year-old producer and his guests record a simple music video for a jointly composed original song, often featuring his signature electropop sheen. They've gone viral not just for his beats, as with the EDM-infused rap banger with the Puerto Rican rapper Viano Antiano, but also for their content. His collaboration with Residente gave rise to a short-lived feud between the Puerto Rican rapper and J Balvin. Most notably, his January track with Shakira, in which she addressed cheating rumors about her husband for the first time, exploded in popularity, breaking several Guinness World Records. Suddenly it had become much more difficult for Bizarrap to fade into the background. Still, the artist has continued to seed the limelight. I make music every day, he says. I like thinking about ideas for my videos, making teasers. I'm always thinking about the next step. He leaves clues on social media as to what those steps might be and who he might collaborate with. Although he has worked with some of the biggest names in the Latin music scene, there are still several on his wish list. At the end of the day, it's all about the songs. What is important to me is that the music speaks for itself. U.S. Drew, D-R-E-W, Afualo, A-F-U-A-L-O. By TikTok's Crusader for Women by Moises Mendez, too. As long as men are terrible online, Drew Afualo will have work. It is like the most aggressive form of job security, she tells Time. I will never run out of content. The 27-year-old creator has amassed 8 million followers on TikTok by giving misogynistic men a taste of their own medicine. The way it usually works, a guy with an alpha male demeanor uploads a video degrading women. Afualo's followers alert her to its presence, and she posts a video in response. Her clapback usually puts their own tactics to work against them. If they can make hurtful comments about women's appearances, her philosophy goes, she can silence them by showing them how it feels. Ask any firefighter. You fight fire with fire, she says. They burn everything in front of it, so the fire has nowhere to go. The Internet has never been a safe place for women. According to the Pew Research Center, 33% of women under 35 say they've been sexually harassed online. While some might find Afualo's tactics less than diplomatic, her cleverly constructed roasts have helped deflate the egos of many a misogynistic troll. And you have to be a gifted comedian in concept and delivery to come up with the comebacks she does. Afualo asks that those who find her content off-putting interrogate their own internalized misogyny, and for many women, tendency to seek validation from men. It is so common for men to be terrible online and suffer no consequence because it is easy to be anonymous, she says. I like to think of myself as a tangible consequence. Consuming such a large amount of rancid material, as she puts it, could take a toll on one's mental health, but Afualo sees the fruits of her labor in the comments section, both literally and in her Spotify exclusive podcast, aptly named The Comment Section with Drew Afualo, where she interviews guests like Kim Petras and Bob the Drag Queen, and in messages from supporters. They tell her she's given them the strength to confront the men who treat them poorly or to break up with abusive partners. It does get very heavy to deal with all the hate I receive, which is a lot, Afualo says. But knowing she has inspired her followers to stand up for themselves, she says, helps remind me why I do what I do. This item may be abridged. Hong Kong, Henry Edwards C., TSE, a trailblazer for transgender rights in Asia. By Chad de Guzman. Since returning to Hong Kong in 2017, transgender activist Henry Edwards says he feels like he's been running a marathon, except the government keeps moving the finish line. C., 32, scored a historic legal victory in February when the city's top court ruled against requiring transgender people to undergo full gender-affirming surgery to change their legal gender markers. For many transgender people, surgery can be costly and dangerous, and LGBTQ advocates hope the ruling could pave the way for other nations in largely conservative Asia struggling to implement more inclusive policies. C says the continent is the epicenter of change for the global trans movement. But months later, a small F still sits where an M should be on C's ID. I am essentially blocked from participating in public life, he tells Time. Whenever I use gender-segregated spaces, it is the same story again. C and other advocates continue to protest the stalled implementation by the city's legislative and executive branches of their judicial victory. In a cosmopolitan former British colony that in recent years has quelled many forms of dissent in pursuit of mainland China's national security, C knows he fights an uphill battle. A patriots-only congressional body has meant LGBTQ rights in the Chinese enclave tend to fall short of basic international considerations and typically toe Beijing's less inclusive policy line. And despite wider public acceptance of sexual minorities, some population segments remain unsupportive, including Xi's own parents. With the court ruling yet to be implemented, Xi views his judicial victory as merely staged, and he says he would rather stay in the city to continue the fight. If I don't do it, I don't see how anyone could, Xi says. It is a very demanding job. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.